Good day, and welcome to the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Director Phil Keith. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Connor, and good afternoon, and thank everyone for joining us today. I call the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and Administration of Justice to order. On behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank you for joining us today for this important Commission teleconference meeting. Today, we will continue our panels and testimony on recruitment, training, and retention with today's teleconference focus specifically on training. As I mentioned yesterday, this is Police Week. The National Law Enforcement Memorial Fund will hold a virtual candlelight ceremony this evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and I would encourage all commissioners to watch this solemn event. This year, 307 more names are being engraved on the wall at the National Law Enforcement Memorial. You can view the vigil online at nleomf.org, nleomf.org. Thank you. At this time, I would ask our Executive Director, Dean Keeter, to conduct a roll call of commissioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before we get started today, I would just like to remind everybody that today's event is open to the press. And for any members of the media on the call, if you have questions or need clarification on anything, please contact Christina Mastropasqua in the Justice Department's Public Affairs Office. And with that, I will begin the roll call. Commissioner Bowditch.
I'm here.
Commissioner Clemens.
Here.
Commissioner Evans. Commissioner Frazier. Commissioner Galtieri. Commissioner Hawkins.
Present, thank you.
Commissioner Lombardo.
I'm here, thank you.
Commissioner McDonald.
Good afternoon, present.
Commissioner Moody.
I'm here.
Commissioner Parr.
I'm here.
Commissioner Price.
Good afternoon, I'm here.
Commissioner Ramsey. Commissioner Rausch.
I'm here.
Commissioner Samaniego.
I'm here.
Commissioner Smallwood. Vice Chair Sullivan.
I'm here, thank you.
And Commissioner Washington.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes the roll call.
Thank you. Any other announcements today?
No, sir, we're good to go.
Thank you. All commissioners should have bios and most of the testimony for this panel. And as a reminder, we'll be posting all these materials on the Law Enforcement Commission website. Once again, we continue to acknowledge everyone's commitments, efforts, and contributions to meet the goals of this historic commission. And on behalf of General Barr, we thank each of you. As noted on previous calls, we encourage commissioners to take notes during the testimony of the panelists, and then we'll open up for questions after the last witness. Our first distinguished panelist is Eric Borgie, I think I got that, Borgie, Director of the Colorado Peace Officer Standards Training Commission. Prior to joining the Colorado Peace Officer Standards and Training, he served as Deputy Chair for many years. Last year, Director Borgie was elected second Vice President of the International Association of Directors for Law Enforcement Standards and Training, commonly referred to as IATLAS. He's also been passionate about training and will all benefit from his recommendations today. Director Borgie, thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon, Director Keith, Vice Chair Sullivan, and members of the Commission. It is an extreme honor and a privilege to have been asked to testify to you today. I am Eric Bo Borgie, a lot easier to pronounce my last name, the Director of Colorado Peace Officer Standards and Training, or POST. I became post director after retiring after 20 years of service in a smaller, more rural community located at the very top of Colorado's Rocky Mountains. Colorado Post sets the minimum standards for and has regulatory oversight over the 30-plus basic reserve and refresher law enforcement training academies in the state. Additionally, Colorado Post ensures compliance with in-service training mandates for Colorado peace officers, creates online and in-person training, and distributes about $3.8 million in grant funding to Colorado law enforcement agencies annually for peace officer training. Post is also responsible for enforcing statute and post rule in issuing and revoking peace officer certification. The basic law enforcement training academies lay the very foundation for a peace officer's career. Done properly, improving training in the academies can help peace officers serve their communities better and even possibly save agency resources by decreasing the amount of time needed in field training programs. My first recommendation is the creation of national guidance on the use of evidence-based modern adult learning concepts to increase the core competencies required for law enforcement. Today, most law enforcement training is lecture-based, which can be appropriate in some instances for teaching basic information. However, this teaching methodology isn't very effective for creating deep understanding with adult learners and does nothing to develop the core competencies needed by our peace officers, such as critical thinking, emotional intelligence, interpersonal communication, and decision-making under stress. This traditional teaching methodology is failing our peace officers and crime victims. How can we reasonably expect our new peace officers to treat victims of domestic violence with the care and compassion they deserve if the first time they are experiencing the emotions and complexities of these situations is when they are in the field? In the best case scenario, the new peace officer is still in the FTO program with an experienced trainer to guide them. In the worst case scenarios, especially likely in our small and rural jurisdictions, their first domestic violence call may come when they are on their own with backup an hour away. Instead, we can better prepare our peace officers by using facilitated discussions to increase their depth of knowledge, problem-based learning to enhance critical thinking, and realistic scenarios to develop emotional intelligence and increase interpersonal communication skills, among other methods. Making the scenarios as realistic as possible is key. Providing immediate feedback allows recruits to learn and grow. In the traditional lecture and learning environment, topic areas are almost always covered in blocks. Using a 50 to 60% scenario-based education, de-escalation can be used to varying degrees in every scenario instead of just comprising a 2 or 4 hour block of instruction. Similarly, mental health, both for the community at large and for our peace officers, can be woven into nearly every instructional topic. Interpersonal communication would become a skill practiced daily, with experts providing feedback on its effectiveness. I firmly believe that if law enforcement is provided a tool or a resource, they will use it. One of the major hurdles for academies or law enforcement agencies nationally from adopting these evidence-based instructional methodologies is a lack of understanding and a lack of expertise in effectively creating this type of training. That is why national guidance on these methodologies and their importance is so vital. This guidance should contain a blueprint on how to develop and implement these types of courses, as well as examples of possible scenarios, grading forms, actor scripts, and other associated documents. My second recommendation is the creation of a national training grant available to law enforcement training academies to implement and deliver these training concepts, as well as to improve and or create training facilities. Unfortunately, these types of trainings are much more resource intensive than lecture-based instruction. Non-law enforcement actors are needed to follow specific but variable scripts during the scenarios. Props are an essential part of the training, and realistic training environments are needed. While the FBI Hogan's Alley is the gold standard, it is entirely possible to retrofit defunct schools as law enforcement training facilities, like the Frank DeAngelis Center for Community Safety in Jefferson County, Colorado, or abandoned big box stores could be purchased to have mock apartments or houses built inside. These facility improvements could also act as regional training hubs, helping local law enforcement by providing them the ability to access these facilities. Not having a location to train is another substantial hurdle to the implementation of adequate training. The third recommendation is that a scientific-based study be conducted to assess the effectiveness of these instructional methodologies and their impact on crime rates, uses of force, complaints leveled against peace officers, internal affairs investigations, retention, and termination rates. While we know that these instructional methodologies are the most effective when teaching adult learners, we do not know the impact they may have on law enforcement. It is vitally important to validate the overall impact that these newer instructional methodologies have on law enforcement so that we can learn how to improve upon them. Fourth, I recommend that a national job task analysis be completed in order to ascertain topics of common interest for law enforcement training academies across the nation. Job task analyses inform post organizations and training academies on where their efforts should be focused to produce successful police officers. Identifying national common areas of interest would allow for the creation of standardized lesson plans for these topics that posts or academies could use, freeing up efforts or resources that could be directed elsewhere. Lastly, I recommend a change in the verbiage of 28 CFR 20.3B to include the certification of peace officers as part of the definition of administration of criminal justice. Who attends law enforcement training academies or enters the law enforcement profession is of vital importance to not just law enforcement, but to our communities. The gatekeepers, post organizations, are currently denied access to certain types of CJIS records, creating a needless barrier to preventing bad actors from becoming or remaining peace officers. That concludes my testimony. Thank you to the commissioners and to the commission for the excellent work you are doing for law enforcement, our communities, and this nation. I will be available at the end of the testimony for any questions.
Thank you, Director Bourgeois, for your informative testimony and certainly your service. Our next distinguished panelist is Sheriff Rick Bradshaw from Palm Beach County, Florida. Sheriff Bradshaw was sworn in as Sheriff of Palm Beach County in 2005 after rising through the ranks of the West Palm Beach Police Department. His law enforcement experience is extensive, serving in every rank and ultimately as the Chief of Police for the Palm Beach Police Department. Sheriff Bradshaw's 49 years of experience provides him with extensive knowledge and training in all aspects of law enforcement, with special emphasis on domestic security, field operations, community-based policing. Sheriff Bradshaw, thank you for joining us today. You're recognized.
Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon, Commissioners. Again, I am Rick Bradshaw, the Sheriff of Palm Beach County. Just a little bit about the Sheriff's Office. It's a large Sheriff's Office, 4,300 people. We do about 1.3 million calls for service every year with a $755 million budget. Palm Beach County is the largest county east of the Mississippi land-wise, and we got about 1.6 million people. You've got my testimony there written, so I'm going to just kind of synopsize this a little bit in the interest of time, and I don't like reading these things anyhow. So the issue as I see this is pretty simple, being in this job and being in a municipal police department and being in the sheriff's office and being in contact with a lot of agencies around the country. We tend to, in these police agencies, you know, we don't pay attention so much to the capital human investment that we need to make in our organizations. We get tied up in the day-to-day solving the problems, putting out the fires, and then lo and behold, our executives are up in years of age, getting ready to retire, and the people that we think are going to fill them have little or no formal leadership or management training. They've kind of got it on the way up through the ranks because the agency is not willing to spend the money and make the investment. I've always been a really big believer in the combination of formal experience and the education that you get from the formal setting in universities. This gives the leadership person the 360-degree view that he needs to have to run a sizable organization. And the peer-to-peer schools that are out there are excellent, and I will name some of those later on. In the sheriff's office, and I did this in my other organization, leadership and executive training starts when they come out of the police academy. We weave that into our normal training sessions with the beginning deputies because we want them to have leadership ability so they can take control of situations on the road and on the street and maybe reduce the outcome of those situations not being what they should be and having to use force when, in fact, if they had leadership abilities, they can control situations. The education in organizations has to be stressed throughout the organization. People have to understand it's important. In my prior organization and in the sheriff's office here, We stress organization from the very beginning. Nobody from the rank of captain or above is going to be promoted to those positions unless they have a master's degree or above. And to enforce that, we give points on the promotional exams, but we also tell people we will pay for everything, your books, your tuition, whatever it is to get you where you need to be with your education. We will pay for it up to a master's degree and make sure that you have the time to accomplish that. So we stress that in our organization. So once we've identified the individuals that are coming up through the ranks that we believe are our future leaders, we make sure that we're going to find the best possible future training sites for them going forward. Just some of those that we regularly are involved in would be the FBI Academy, which is associated with the University of Virginia, Southern Police Institute, which is the University of Louisville, Police Executive Research Forum, which is the Senior Management Institute, and Harvard's Senior Executive School, which we have found to be absolutely excellent. So the bottom line is, if you don't make that investment in your human capital, then you're only going to get out of it what you put into it. So the recommendations that I'm putting forward here, they're really pretty simple. First of all, find out where you're at. I listed about 7 different questions that are good to make an assessment in your organization. You don't know where to go unless you know where you're at. So it's good for organizations to do the self-assessment, ask those questions. Be willing to make the investment in the people that are going to be your future leaders. Don't try to say they're going to get it on their own. Let's make sure they're going to get it, and let's make sure that they know and the organization knows what the value of it is on the investment of human capital. And then make sure that your leadership, both your formal and informal leaders, have a mutual commitment. Your senior leaders, your junior leaders, they need to work towards what tomorrow is going to bring, because tomorrow comes very, very fast. And finally, you know, and we really didn't see this coming, but it's more timely than ever. Several years ago, because of how spread out we are, we have 20 different districts spread out throughout this entire county, we realized we can't put everybody in a classroom all the time. So the distance learning became very important. Being able to do this remotely without a classroom setting, without having to put everybody in a classroom, became very important. And now, under the constraints that we're under, we found out that it's going to be even more valuable to be able to train our people where we need to train them without having everybody in close proximity. So I would definitely suggest that people are going to have to make the investment in technology and figure out how to make that work. So these are pretty simple recommendations, and you would think they're common sense, but again, I go back to the fact that the organization's got to be willing to make that assessment. They have to be willing to make that investment in the human capital to make sure that the workforce is going to look like it should. And not only are we doing really something that's good for our employees, but it's also paying off for the quality of service that we're going to provide to our community. So again, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you. I hope these recommendations are going to be helpful, and I appreciate the fact that this commission has taken the time to look into all the aspects, not only of the basic recruit training, but what we need to do to make sure that our law enforcement executives are going to be where they need to be in the future.
Thank you, Sheriff Bradshaw, for your valued testimony and certainly for your 49 years of dedicated service. Our last panelist today is Sheriff Bill Brueggemann from Cass County, Nebraska. Sheriff Brueggemann has more than 3 decades of law enforcement experience and is currently serving on a number of leadership groups, including the National Sheriff's Association and the Western States Sheriff's Association. In addition to his law enforcement career, he served 13 years for the Nebraska National Guard. Sheriff Brueggemann, thank you for joining us today. You're recognized.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you, Director Keefe, also Vice Chair Katie Sullivan, and all you commissioners. I believe that without your efforts and partnerships, along with the support, of course, of Attorney General Barr, the completion of this historic executive order is not going to be possible. So thank you for what all of you are doing. A little bit about our county. We're located on the eastern edge of Nebraska, bordered on the east by the Missouri River, on the north by the city of Omaha, and on the west by the city of Lincoln, which are the two biggest cities in Nebraska. Our population is a grand total of 26,000. County seat's got 7,000 people in it, and we have 560 square miles containing 13 towns within its borders. Our law enforcement center is fairly new. It's 18 years old. It houses the sheriff's office and the Plaffin Police Department, which is the county seat. I have a total of 74 employees. 36 of those are sworn, and 15 of those sworn actually work in the jail. So while my numbers are low, there are so many other numbers that are so much lower. I've listened to this testimony, not just over the past few days, but over the past couple months, and I think all these recommendations, I think every one of those presenters are right on spot. They're telling how to get it done, how to make it better. However, you know, I'm a big supporter of the rural and small agencies, and one shoe does not fit for every agency. Rural America, if you don't know, consists of 90% of the United States. 86% of every agency in the U.S. has less than 50 sworn officers. And nearly half of all those law enforcement agencies have fewer than 10 officers. So one shoe, again, does not fit all. We have a new breed of officers. And with a new breed of officers, they have new needs that we've never seen before. Call me old school, but I am. I'm a true believer that I shouldn't dip my colors to seek out the needs of some of these newer officers, these new inexperienced officers, but rather than fly my colors high for the people that we serve. Last year, I lost 8 deputies. 6 of those deputies went to larger agencies that pay starting. You drive 10 miles away, they get $3 more an hour than what we can pay. Our county is, our tax base is farmers. There is no extra money for bonuses or to raise the wages or anything like that. And so when we see these officers coming in and they see that the grass is greener on the other side, and it truly is. I mean, you look at 15 miles away, they got license plate readers and all this cool equipment. And, you know, rural counties, rural cities, they'd be happy if they can get a radar, if they can get a radio that works. Again, so it's totally different what people want, and it's hard. It's so very hard to keep these people. I've attended, and I have one deputy that I sent to other places, 8 different job careers, job fairs at colleges, career fairs every year. And it's amazing that out of the 9 years we've been doing that, we have not hired one person from any of those colleges. But last year we had Kansas City coming up and going to a college that's got 3,000 students, and they're actually trying to hire. They're hurting for people, too. They're hiring people from Nebraska and great officers. They send 4 officers. We send 1 officer. It shows you a little bit of difference about the capabilities of what smaller agencies can do. Retention, you know, we deal with larger agencies. I lost a deputy yesterday, my first one this year. I'm sure there's going to be plenty more. The cost to retain, to keep. I know a police chief who's from a town of 2,000 people. It took him 19 months to find one officer or one candidate that could meet the qualifications needed. He would hire one, and another agency, a larger agency, would take it from him before they actually got certified. This is real America. This is not something that, I know our statistics are out there, but we have such a tough issue trying to keep people, trying to find people, that it's not the, I tell people money is the answer to everything, and money doesn't grow on trees. There is a association, there's costs associated with all the training. If you send somebody to training, smaller agencies, these 1- and 2-man departments, a lot of them don't go to training because there's nobody to cover for them. A lot of them you will see that don't meet the required hours that they have to put in, because if they're not working out on the road because they might be the only officer, they're out there trying to help a farmer get his cattle off the highway, and next thing you know he's doing investigation of a burglary. You have to have multitask officers in these small rural areas. So I'm not going to bore you talking about all my problems and everybody else's problems. I will give you some simple recommendations for retention. I believe it would help if we established a funding source for tuition reimbursement for college credits taken while they're actually employed with the agency. I think that would help maybe keep some of the people. Also establish a retirement investment system for law enforcement officers to ensure that they'll continue to receive these benefits during their entire retirement, not just for the short term, like most of us are faced with. Recommendations for training. I think if you could establish a funding source to allow those small and rural agencies to pay overtime for an officer to cover the shifts while they have someone else attending training. So those same funds can also be used to pay the wages for another officer to come from another agency to cover those shifts if you don't have anybody else on your department. I also believe that during this, you're going to have to establish some type of legislation that would allow the groundwork for cross-deputization to make this possible, so that person will continue to have arrest powers even though he's going into another jurisdiction. Require federal training academies to make more seats available for small and rural agencies. A lot of us smaller agencies would love to go to them. Most of the seats are sucked up, taken by larger agencies, as are most of the grant funding that's out there. It's first come, first serve in most cases. I believe establish regional training centers that will offer on-site training, not only on-site training, but also take the training to those remote multi-agency training locations and make available some type of funding to get those officers to that location, where like in Nebraska, you might have to drive 300 miles just to get to the only state's academy. So sometimes they, if you want to go to a national training, they can't afford the cost associated with that. So you could also establish regional training centers that will offer not only on-site training, but can also be take that training to the remote the multi-agency training location and make that funding available. My recommendations for hiring is establish funding source to hire for hiring bonuses for those agencies who fall under the rural and small category with a payout employment contract of some type, like they get paid one-third of that at hiring, one-third of it at successful completion of the academy or certification, and one-third after their second year of employment. That will at least keep them there for 2 years. And I think it would be great if you could create a nationwide high school sanctioned program to allow students to enroll in some type of criminal justice class in which they actually receive school credits for the successful completion of the class. This would be similar to the ROTC program that the military uses in schools today. That is the completion of my testimony, and I will follow it up with a written testimony.
Thank you, Sheriff Klergeman, for your valued testimony and for your law enforcement service and certainly your service to our country. Commissioners, we're now open for questions for the witnesses. Commissioners with questions, please state your name prior to your question and direct the question to the specific panelists or the entire panel. Just as a reminder to the commissioners, your mics are hot at all times. With that, commissioners with questions for our panelists.
Hi, this is Katie.
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Bo, I'll direct this at you, but I would love to hear from the other panelists as well on the idea of having experiential learning, I think is what you were saying. And what is the barrier? And if it is funding, how could the funds potentially be made up by the efficiency of the experiential type of training academy that you outlined in your testimony? And thank you all very much. Thank you for your service and great testimony today. Thank you.
I think the funding could be used not only to establish the physical base for some type of a remote training location, but also people have to get paid. These speakers need to get out to the officers in these rural and small agencies and talk to them. Now, we all know that it's not financially possible to send somebody over to train one or two people. So if you go out into an outstate location someplace and try and get multi-agencies together to host that, there's costs associated with hosting, whether it's at a facility. A lot of these facilities can only hold 10 people in a classroom. If you want to, you know, to pay for the motel room, to pay for, again, the speaker, or to pay for the materials. For instance, if you are a school resource officer, there's materials that you can buy to help you in those schools, but the money's not available at our level as far as that. We can't go to the commissioners. If you do go to the commissioners and say, I need some funding to host some training, and they say, well, what are you going to take out of your budget to pay for that? And that's how it is in the small and rural agencies. It's difficult to promote yourself when you're not able to. Did I answer your question?
Yes. I kind of wanted to find out, too. You talked about not a lecture-style training to Bo from Colorado, but more of that experiential training. And I'm wondering, what's the barrier to, is there a barrier to implementing that? What is the barrier? What do we need to do to make that type of training acceptable or used? Do you understand what I mean?
Yes, I'm not sure I know the answer. I think, first of all, you have to get each state to recognize that type of online training and get credits for it. That would probably be the first step to be able to do that. Second of all, to get quality material to teach. There are so many things out there that you can get to have your people get online and for training classes. However, if you don't get one that's respected or in your state or for your agency, it doesn't do a lot of good to go to that training. I think the groundwork to get it all started, I think the groundwork might be, if we're talking about funding, is to be able to make one site available for training maybe across the United States. And I know that IACP, National Sheriff's Association, they all have training sites where you can get materials from. Here we actually go through our insurance carrier who hosts some of the training. But I think it would be nice that if we could standardize more, even though each state's needs are different, if we could standardize it more at a one-stop shop location.
Vice Chair Sullivan, this is Beau Bergeri from Colorado.
Yes, sir, you're right, yes.
Thank you, sir. I think there's a couple of really huge hurdles. One is kind of a sea change, and that's changing the traditional instructional methods that have been used in law enforcement. So right now everybody's very used to doing the lecture-based methodology. And they're really not aware of the new adult learning methodologies that I discussed earlier that it helps to increase those core competencies. So first off is education and giving a tool or resource for agencies to use that they can easily implement their own training program in that mode. So having a toolkit of sorts around how to do this type of experiential training is extremely important. The second is training location. In Colorado, there are locations where we have to rent out a restaurant in order to host law enforcement training, and that's another huge barrier to have these trainings happen across the state. And so, being able to get regionalized training facilities that multiple agencies can utilize certainly would help reduce that barrier. Now, the last is, of course, funding to make these happen and also to pay for actors to come in, to pay for equipment. Idaho Academy and Meridian have a great triage program to teach officers how to use their IPAC kits, their tourniquets. And that involves moulage, where they actually have actors who are quote unquote bleeding and learn how to stop the bleeding that way. Well, those things cost some funds. Now there can be some cost savings on the agency side if we do a good enough job at the academy and expose the recruits to these experiences. That could lessen the time in the FTO programs or field training officer programs when they get to their agencies. So that could actually help the agencies with their staffing and manpower by giving them those experiences, and those firsthand experiences while at the academy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Director. Director, while we're talking about that, could you address the in-service training challenges, both on delivery as well as substance for Colorado?
Yes, sir. Thank you. So Colorado mandates 24 hours of annual in-service training per certified peace officer. We've gone a couple of different routes in this to make this happen. First was we were able to get a $1 per vehicle registration fee that totally funds POST. That allows us to invest about $3.8 million a year through training grants to local law enforcement regions and agencies to help with their in-service training efforts. Our requirements are pretty broad-based in that we require at least 12 hours of those 24 to be in perishable skills and the other 12 hours to be in whatever topic the agency would like. So really it's to encourage more of that education. Again, so one of the barriers that we have is, well, there's two barriers really. One is facilities on how to, where are these officers going to train if they're doing in-person classes. But the second barrier, and probably the most important barrier, is for our small and rural agencies. So if you have a three-person department, how do we get one of those people off to go to an in-person class? So they just don't have the depth in staff to make that happen. And so I use CIT as an example. I think every officer in the nation should be trained on crisis intervention techniques. And especially in our small rural agencies, they don't have the same mental health resources everybody else does, and so these officers are the ones who bear the brunt. So how do we get all these three folks to train? What we've done in Colorado is we've implemented what we call a very small agency backfill program, and that allows a very small agency, 10 or fewer officers, to apply to POST to make sure that we have the funding available to have an officer from a larger jurisdiction come to their jurisdiction to cover their shifts while they go off to training. I actually got that idea from a former sheriff of mine who had done it to help out somebody else, and I thought, that's such out-of-the-box thinking. Why can't we do it across the state and make it work? To date, we've had some successes with the program in getting, again, larger agencies to go to the smaller agencies to fill in their shifts and allow for that in-person training to happen for the small and rural agencies.
Thank you, Director. Sheriff Bradshaw, the same question to you about in-service training, the challenges and platforms you use.
Yeah, well, having the size agency I have with the 4,300 people, 1,700 of them are sworn law enforcement. The other 1,000 is corrections. The training budget is $2.2 million, and that's because it's just a whole bunch of people to get trained throughout the entire year when you have a 40-hour requirement through the state to get the different things. We have found that the successes that we have with the distance learning, with computer courses that are proxied, even with firearms, we have had built a mobile firearms trailer. It's actually a 40-foot tractor trailer that was turned into a two-person firearms facility that we can take to our 20 different agencies throughout the county, because we just can't get everybody into one spot like the director was talking about there. So the more that you can use your distance learning, the more you can use your computer courses, the more you can make it to where the people can get in and out of a training session like the firearms qualification without having to be too far off the road or go to a specific firing range, that's way out of the way, the better off you're going to be. What we do also is for the smaller agencies, because we know they have a funding problem, when we put on a class that is going to actually be in a classroom setting, we will invite the agencies to send somebody at no charge and do the same thing. We'll actually, if they're a very small agency where they only have three or four people, we'll actually run the road for them while they can take everybody there and get the training. And I think that, somewhere down the road, for the incentive for the larger agencies that put on the training free of charge for all the smaller agencies, there ought to be some, a break on getting some funding from the federal government to offset that a little bit. Even though, we do have the resources to do it, it's still a budgetary problem. So the matter of the fact is training is essential. training is essential not only for the safety of the officers, but for the safety of the public. I mean, we found out the hard way that, you know, the number of police officer shootings we were involved in could be reduced significantly by enhancing our training, enhancing our abilities for the verbal judo, enhancing our ability to be able to deal with mental health issues, and actually reduced the number of police officer shootings by almost 60% just by enhancing the training. So I'm a huge believer in training, and the more we can do, the better. It's just a matter of figuring out the ways we're going to do it. And like I said, even more now with what we have with this COVID problem, distance learning is going to be a real big issue.
Thank you, Sheriff. Other commissioners with questions? Other commissioners with questions?
Yeah, Director Keith, this is Craig Price.
Yes, sir, you're recognized, Commissioner.
Thank you. This is for Eric out of Colorado. Certainly appreciate everybody's testimony today, and having been on the State Law Enforcement Training Commission in my state of South Dakota for almost 9 years, I have a big passion for this, and have a quick question in regards to any studies that, Eric, you may be aware of that shows that lecture-based training is much less effective than adult learning type training. And then secondly, in our state, we have three academies held each year, and law enforcement officers from all across the state come to the capital city of Pierre within the first year of being hired by a police agency to be certified. It's a 13-week training academy, and then they go back to their departments and in some cases have a field training program, and in some cases that's formalized, and others it's probably not. Curious on your thoughts on moving parts of training academies to an online version, and if so, how would that change or impact the studies that may or may not exist on the ineffectiveness of lecture-based learning?
Yes, sir. Eric Bergeri from Colorado. So in Colorado, we're using a blended learning method currently. So normally the academies are only in-person instruction, but it's lecture-based. For in-service, we do allow remote learning, and we develop remote learning to be used due to the problems of getting people off-shift to go to training. So, the remote learning is better than no learning. As far as the studies on the lecture-based learning being ineffective, I don't know that it's a matter of the lecture-based learning being ineffective, as it really is that we could be doing more effective learning through the scenario based. And so, there's no studies specific to law enforcement that I'm aware of today, but there have been studies in the adult learning realm that show that experiential training does cement the learning better with adults. They take more of an ownership over that knowledge, and they learn the material better. And so that's one, so the nexus here with law enforcement is why I was making a recommendation that we do a study on the programs that are heading in this direction to see what type of impact that it really has on law enforcement, because I think we need to have that evidence-based foundation moving forward with this. Lastly, I believe that we can do blended learning methods on certain topic areas, even in the academies. So while I'm emphasizing scenario-based learning, there is a place to do blended learning where you could do certain topics remotely to learn the foundational knowledge, then come in and have a facilitated discussion to create a more internalizing of that knowledge and a deeper understanding before then moving on to reinforcement by scenario-based or experiential-based learning. Thank you.
Yes, very good. I appreciate your feedback. Thank you, sir.
Other commissioners with questions? Uh, other commissioners with questions. Hearing no further questions, let me close by thanking our panelists once again for your time and your most valuable testimony and responses to the questions from commissioners. On behalf of the Attorney General and his leadership team of Rachel Bissick and Jeff Avita and all the commissioners, your contributions provided today are most sincerely appreciated and will assist the Commission in their deliberations and work. Before we close, just a reminder about tonight's virtual candlelight vigil, and that our last hearing this week will be tomorrow, Thursday. And just for the record, let the record reflect that Commissioner Evans is on the call. Also, please check the President's Commission page for additional updates of documents and information on Maine Justice websites, and we'll update that website regularly when we receive information. Are there any comments or questions from commissioners?
Mr. Chair, this is Commissioner Smallwood. I'm here as well.
Yes, sir, Commissioner. Thank you for joining us today. Other comments or questions from commissioners? If there's no further business before us today, the President's Commission is adjourned. Thank you again, commissioners, for your dedication and continued commitment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation.
Yes, sir.
You may now disconnect.
Speak.